Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, the historian Benjamin Zachariah tells us about the activities of India's governing party at home and abroad. It's no exaggeration, as you will soon hear, to call the BJP a fascist party. And then at the bottom of the hour, David Reif will talk about the economic development establishment and its chimerical campaign to make poverty history. First, Benjamin Zachariah. He is a professor of history specializing in modern India at the University of Trier in Germany. India's governing party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, is, it's not excessive to say, a fascist entity based in extreme Hindu nationalism. It's gotten some good press abroad because Prime Minister Narendra Modi has a good publicist and has been sweet-talking global capital. But its domestic record is one of violence and repression. Last month, Jawaharlal Nehru University was a site of conflict over protest and repression. This is a good point of entry into an investigation of what the BJP is all about. Here's Ben Zachariah with more. Let's start by talking about the recent incidents at JNU. What is JNU, where is it, and what's been happening?
Jawaharlal Nehru University was a university founded in Delhi to be a kind of memorial to the first Indian Prime Minister and also a center for learning, which was mostly postgraduate. And so it's always been a research institute. They only have undergraduate courses in the languages. It's always been a kind of protected institution and was meant to be an elite institution in many ways.
And now there's been a whole lot of controversy around it the last weeks. What set things off?
Well, I think what has set things off over the years is that it isn't any longer an elite institution in terms of the people it gets. It has a very wide variety of students. And what set things off was that they have students from all over the country who are actually expressing dissent. Theoretically, the problem was that there was a meeting to debate. It ended up debating the hanging of one Afzal Guru, who was implicated in the bombing of Parliament some years ago. It's considered an unsafe conviction, and the hanging was done in haste and in private. And of course, many people, not just extremists, think that the conviction was unsafe. What happened at the time was allegedly anti-national slogans were raised. Now, what anti-national means is anybody's guess. More precisely, there were apparently two masked figures who were raising these slogans in the background. Nobody's identified them yet, and the Delhi chief minister, who is not of the ruling party, has now said that they were protected by the BJP government, so he's making a case for agents provocateurs. The upshot was that the Jawaharlal Nehru University Students' Union president was arrested. Two other people from a small party which no longer exists, it was a fringe group at the best of times, were then later arrested after various threats were made. And of course, so far the courts have done their job. The JNUSU president has been acquitted. They could find no evidence that he'd done anything anti-national, which in any case is not a legal category. But ever since then, there's been low-level violence and low-level intimidation going on against the university staff and students on campus and outside it.
Those who were arrested were charged under sedition laws, right?
Yes.
For protest? What exactly were they accused of saying that merited such a heavy charge?
I don't think they actually worked that out, because what turns out to have happened is that the videos that were shown on television, one particular channel, Zee News, has also been accused of doctoring the videos, or of knowing that the videos were doctored and still playing them. These videos don't actually give you a clear sound, and it was found by various experts that the videos had deliberately been doctored. So clearly the channel, which seems to be working very closely with the ruling government, decided to cooperate with some sort of government plot to find some leverage in the university.
Of course, this is part of a larger picture of repression of dissent under the Modi government, correct?
That is right. In fact, the sedition laws are good old colonial laws which were brought in quite late, I think in the 1870s, to challenge a rising independence movement. But the courts have mostly been careful as to how they use them. sedition is not simply a slogan. It has to be an incitement to violence that is clear and present. So even the colonial courts didn't do as much with it as they hoped to be able to do. The most famous victim of the sedition laws was, of course, Gandhi. And the phrasing says something like to bring the government of the country into disrepute. In fact, it's the government and not the state. So the anti-national is not in the sedition law.
You know, in the United States, if I advocate for the overthrow of the government, I can get arrested. But I can say all kinds of mean things about the government and not have to worry. Is this law been used to curb dissent before the Modi government has picked up on it?
Yes, that is actually true. The sedition law was more or less revived by the previous Congress regime, and it was used pretty indiscriminately. The most famous victim of this in recent times was in the state of Chhattisgarh, which is not Congress ruled, a doctor called Binayak Sen, who had documents planted in his papers, and he was then sentenced, I think, to life imprisonment. He was released by the higher courts. But there was an attempt started early on to create a sense of low-level intimidation by using sedition laws. What has increased, however, is it's come closer to home. It's being used in Delhi. It's being used against people who believe themselves to be immune. And as some commentators have said recently, this kind of intimidation with little or no legal redress has been happening outside the view of the national press and the big cities for a long time now.
The Modi government has enjoyed a pretty good international reputation. Just today I saw float by my Twitter feed a picture of Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg hugging Modi on his visit to Palo Alto. And Martin Wolf's column in the Financial Times this week is also says India's economy is doing well, bright spot of the world economy, which is otherwise rather gloomy. You know, there's some problems with some of the extremists in his party, but, you know, that's just worth a paragraph. Basically, it's celebrating what Modi's been doing for India. What do you make of this reputation abroad?
I think it's very carefully massaged. They have a very good propaganda machinery, and all of that is run by American PR firms. The Indian press has spent a lot of time unpacking some of the lies that have been told on Modi's behalf by his American PR firms, but somehow that doesn't get through to American audiences.
I'm guessing the term is that he's running a business-friendly regime and they can overlook all the details?
When you say business-friendly regime, you're actually talking about a very selective business-friendly regime. There's some very big businesses who benefit directly from Modi, one of whom more or less bankrolls him and all his television channels. But actually, for smaller businesses, it hasn't been a good time. And I think that the main point, and this is why many people are now using the analogy with fascism, is that he has a very close link with certain large business houses for whom he's able to act. But smaller businesses are not very happy with what they see as him selling out the country's interests to the interests of international capital rather than sustaining growth at a lower level in the country. And I actually don't think it's particularly true that this is a very pro-business regime. It is certainly a pro-money-making regime.
Pro-money-making for certain cronies?
It's crony capitalism. It's crony capitalism at its worst. You bend all the laws you want. If you wish to mine in a particular area, you just get the government to change the law in that area. You intimidate the residents. You create a state of emergency, claim that there are Maoists in the area, send in the army, and then send the miners after them. This has been happening for a long time.
The BJP, of course, has truly fascist roots, right?
That's true. And I used to be one of the few people who was allowed to say this, and I was always being told that I was exaggerating. I note now, though, that the press in India and outside has used fascism as a descriptor without any problem. It's certainly true that the RSS, the paramilitary group that is behind the BJP, more or less like Hitler's stormtroopers, is actually an older organization than any of these organizations. It was founded in 1923 and is therefore the longest standing fascist organization in the world, I think, if you look at continuity.
What was the origin of the ideology?
I don't think that the Indians needed fascism to be imported from Europe. I think there were elements of this sort of racist and Aryanist ideas that were in circulation across the world at the time. India had its fair version of that. One attempt was to actually link the Hindus in particular to European race theories and to suggest, therefore, that nobody had a right to rule fellow Aryans. That was one of the arguments.
That word Aryan, I've wondered about this for a long time. I mean, the commonality with the Nazi version of Aryan, is that an accident or is that there's a similarity there?
It's the same set of people. In fact, you will find that people like Heinrich Himmler were very interested in Indian mythology, but also Indian students in Austria were flying the Nazi flag long before the Germans annexed Austria.
What was the appeal of this fascist ideology to Indians at the time?
It's a variety of points. One is the idea of having a strong nationalism controlled by an elite who would decide. So the idea was to cleanse the nation of impurities, to create the so-called organic folk, and then to proceed from that to organize around the principle of a strong leader and of ordinary people acting for a greater cause. So the idea of individualism was not particularly valorized anywhere in that.
Well, this sounds like fairly standard issue fascism, then.
It is. I actually don't see a problem with using the term at all. I think the resistance so far has been because there's been an understanding of fascism as successful fascism. And to the extent that India hasn't had a successful fascism till now, and that too outside the so-called classical period of fascism, there's obviously been some sense that the descriptor doesn't work. But that's partly due to the Eurocentrism of the theorists of fascism and not so much due to the fact that you can't find fascism elsewhere in India or even in Argentina or Brazil or whatever.
What was the relation of these early Indian fascists to colonialism? Were they anti-British or what?
It varies. Some of them were anti-British. Some of them were much more interested in cleansing the nation of its Muslim and other minority impurities. Because they have this idea that the British would probably go eventually, and therefore it was more important to get rid of the enemy within. There is actually a polemic that some sections of the left have used against the right and this current dispensation, saying that all the people it claims as their ancestors never really fought colonialism. This is partly true, but it isn't entirely true, and I don't think that's the crucial factor.
Oh, what is the crucial factor then?
Well, I think much more crucial is the idea that you must have a pure nation that decides in a sort of collective will model about what everybody else should do, that it's based on an upper caste Hindu majoritarian self-definition, and it reserves the right to decide who else to tolerate or to murder, depending on the circumstances. In fact, in the present case, most people have regarded the level of violence of the BJP in power as relatively restrained. They use it selectively to intimidate. They kill a person here for allegedly eating beef, burn a mosque there as a celebration for coming to power. It's very similar to what happened, say, in the early years of the Nazi regime, where the idea was to keep people terrified, but not necessarily to create so much violence that resistance became absolutely necessary.
I'm speaking with Benjamin Zachariah, who teaches Indian history at the University of Trier in Germany. India is an extraordinarily diverse place. It's huge and diverse, many languages, you know, all kinds of religions, many regional distinctions. Who is the ideal type to this fascist mind?
I don't think they've thought about it that clearly. Its ideologues clearly think of something like an upper caste Hindu majoritarianism. And I think they're trying actually to create silence rather than dissent by simply asserting things. They're very low on intellectuals. This has been said over and over again.
Now, what about how popular are they? You said this is not a successful fascism as of yet, and they're acting like the early stage Nazis. Do they have deeper roots in the population, and do you see them evolving into a more successful or more expansive or more profound fascism?
Well, I think that a couple of things are acting in parallel. In vote terms, they have 31%, which is not huge. It's surprising that they have over 50% of the seats, but that's one of the dangers of a first-past-the-post electoral system. In terms of larger support, well, the RSS, their paramilitary group, has also diversified into schools, physical fitness organizations, and they have many activities which make them a kind of everyday social service group as well as a service group for violence as an adjunct to the ruling party. And I think taken together, that means that the RSS has had roots which are slightly deeper than they would have had they been demolished after the classical period of fascism. So I think this is something to be considered. There's been a number of very public statements of people who had come through, if you like, the RSS system, schooling, paramilitary education, arms training, violence, petty crime against outsiders. And they have explained why they were in it and why they're now not in it. So it's not entirely that they are simply able to stay in a violent world. The other thing, of course, is that whether this rootedness in everyday lives of people does actually translate into a wide-ranging electoral appeal is a different matter, because I don't think that people necessarily make the connection between the RSS as a social service organization, which is what they always claim they are, and the ruling party. It's certainly true that the use of violence has been integral to the rise of the party.
They do have a very active base of support in the Indian diaspora abroad, right?
Yes, that I think is the crucial factor. I mean, I think what's interesting is that the BJP is in search of intellectual legitimacy. They do not have it. So one of the things they did was they killed academics who did not write in English. And this was interesting because the targeting of academics who write in regional languages was necessary because they had always been able to base themselves on an attempt to declare themselves indigenous. And when people writing in regional languages opposed them, they were in much more danger than people who write in English. Now, abroad, what is dangerous also is that they've been able to link up with a kind of identity politics that says, well, if Blacks, Jews, Muslims, and women can represent themselves, why can't we? So we simply want to be represented in the same way as other minority groups have always wished to be represented.
What do they mean by we in this case?
They definitely mean Hindus. There's all kinds of front organizations they have in the U.S. They've used the term dharma, which is a term to look out for in all their front organizations. There's something called the Hindu Swayam Sevak Sangh, which also has been crucial in raising money. But there are various groups which will form and vanish and reform over time. What's common to all of them is that they are building a conception of India that is Hindu upper caste centered and very violent. It's very intolerant of all forms of dissent, and it wishes the world to see India as Hindu.
Hindus are a sizable majority in India, right?
Actually, it depends on what you mean by Hindu. If you take out many lower caste groups who do not wish to be defined as Hindu, then you don't have a majority. This battle was actually fought in the 1930s, where the British were trying to create electoral reservations, a sort of affirmative action for lower underprivileged groups who would then potentially lean on British power so that they could stay on longer. So it wasn't that the British were doing anybody a favor. But when this game was being played of separate representation for different groups, there was a very strong attempt at getting lower castes, and in particular various groups who had been previously classified as animist or tribal, to identify as Hindu in the census. Without these tricks of the trade, there is no Hindu majority in India. So when most people say Hindu, they mean the upper caste Hindus who they wish to represent. And if they seem to be accommodating lower castes or other people, what they're actually doing is they need the numbers. But the fact that caste violence has increased tremendously under this government, and it's perfectly acceptable to rape and murder Dalit women, it's perfectly acceptable to murder people who have married across caste lines, and a lot more violence. Yesterday's news said that a girl was beaten for throwing her shadow on an upper caste man.
This sounds like the Jim Crow South in the U.S.
It is a lot worse, because I think the fact that Jim Crow had some sort of legal basis meant that there were things you could and couldn't do. At this point, there is no prediction as to what will happen.
Returning to the theme of their support abroad, they recently, a foundation connected to the BJP, recently tried to endow a chair or two at the University of California, Irvine. What happened with that incident?
Well, initially, as I understand it, the university accepted it, or a certain group on behalf of the university accepted it, but they hadn't really taken other practitioners of South Asian studies into their confidence. So they simply announced that money had been accepted and a chair of Dharmic Studies would be set up. Now, the attempt was to suggest, they called it faith-based learning. So they were linking up with an American right-wing rhetoric of anti-secularism, and that had been very important to how they saw themselves. Initially, after the acceptance, various concerned people started raising questions about how it would work if a frankly sectarian point of view was embodied in a permanent chair. There was also a lot of talk about setting the parameters of application so that only certain sympathetic people could apply. They've done some homework, this group, and they learnt a few academic terms from the 1970s. Emic and etic came up a lot, and anthropologists like to talk about an internalist and an externalist view as emic and etic. And they insisted that they needed somebody to teach Hinduism who was emic. And they even had a lined up candidate, apparently. But especially because of that, UC Irvine eventually decided that this was not such a good idea, as it could definitely curtail academic freedom. There are also various procedural points, and these are still being discussed at the university. I'm only visiting, so I haven't any access to some of these debates.
But is this characteristic of the way the BJP allies are operating abroad? Do they have these foundations that are really trying to inject themselves in, you know, academic and ideological debates in the outside world?
Oh, yes. They've had this for a very long time. They've been aiming at it at least since the 1980s. And they have specifically targeted diasporic groups who feel that they are somehow not fully accepted in their host communities and therefore hark back to an idealized picture of the home which they have never seen. So, of course, the rhetoric for them has always been slightly different to the rhetoric at home, which is much more hardline, much less subtle.
What are the prospects for resisting this creeping fascism?
I think what has happened as a result of the JNU incidents, and also incidents that have happened in several other universities that have not had the same publicity because they are not as in the public eye as JNU, is that more and more people think this is a sign of overreach. I actually think that the BJP had assumed an easier access to power, but dissent was in fact amplified when they came to power, and it didn't actually die down. So they've targeted specific educational institutions, and they have a plan, I think. The Film and Television Institute of India, which is very important as a feeder route to all forms of media, has had a BJP appointee as their vice chancellor, and there's been a lot of protest about that. And JNU has had this problem. They had an incident of a suicide of a Dalit student in the Central University of Hyderabad, who was specifically targeted by the ministry and expelled for alleged anti-national activities. So it's a coordinated plan. I think the prospect for resistance comes itself, unfortunately, from the fact that we've had a stepping up of repression. So I think many people who thought they could ride out a BJP government have realized that they can't.
That was Benjamin Zachariah, who teaches modern Indian history at the University of Trier, Karl Marx's hometown, in Germany. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
Don't just sit there on your ass and look at funky chain dance. Brother, sister, shoot your best. We don't need this fascist group thing.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist group thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist group thing.
History will repeat itself. Point, we're nearly out. Down to force will do no good. Pop you out and do your part.
That was some of We Don't Need This Fascist Groove Thing from Heaven 17. When the song came out in 1981, it was banned by the BBC because it was mean to Ronald Reagan. Next, David Reif. Reif is a prolific author and journalist who's written mainly on international affairs, war, refugees, and development. His latest book, The Reproach of Hunger, Food, Justice, and Money in the 21st Century, was published late last year by Simon & Schuster. The global development establishment, from the World Bank to the Gates Foundation to Jeffrey Sachs, talks constantly and fatuously about ending poverty in our lifetime. This is not a plausible goal given the structure of the world economy and the meager resources devoted to ending poverty, something that capitalism has a long history of creating alongside wealth. David Reif explores these contradictions in his book, and here he is to give us a taste of the critique. David Reif. Those of us who live in well-fed precincts, don't often think about hunger, but there's still a lot of it in the world, right? Lay out the dimensions of the problem of hunger and malnutrition.
First thing to say is when people talk about hunger, what they actually are often talking about is famine. And the only good news there is to report in the world of hunger, in my view anyway, is that we really have cracked the back of famine. Even where there are famines, such as the Horn of Africa, they're less lethal than they used to be. That's obviously a small comfort to the people suffering from them, but it's something. It's a real accomplishment of the whatever, whosever accomplishment it is. Whenever I say we, I get nervous, but sometimes it's unavoidable. But what hasn't been at all cracked is chronic malnutrition and undernutrition. And there are about 1 billion people in the world who suffer from that. And we know the neurological cost, for one thing. I mean, there's a lot of work that's been done by neurologists and other people who would show that unless a pregnant woman, the embryo, and the infant and up to the age of 2 is well nourished, that a very large number, a very high percentage of them will have some problems, either, you know, not being the right weight, not being the right height, being stunted, etc., having some cognitive damage. So it, you know, 1 billion people, that's 1 in 7 of us. That's hardly, the world we all like to live in.
Now, to some people, I guess economists who have somewhat simple-minded views of the world, it's just a matter of poverty. Is it just that poor people, hungry people don't have enough money?
Well, it would certainly help to have some money. And to be honest, cash transfers have worked a lot better in places like Brazil and even Mexico. Everyone talks about Mexico as a basket case, but actually quite a lot of things work well in Mexico, including a steadily diminishing number of hungry people. Look, the problem is not the supply of food. This is the great mystification. There's enough food to feed 7.5 billion people. It's maldistributed, and it's inequitably distributed. So, you know, to my way of thinking, which is, to put it charitably, not the mainstream view, the problem of hunger is principally a problem of justice. That is to say, to sort of turn your question quite sort of 45 degrees to the left. The reason these people don't have enough money is because they live in inequitable, unequal, unjust society. includes our own, by the way. I mean, we don't have the numbers of malnourished or undernourished people that, say, Mali does, but we have a disgracefully high number, that number in the millions. And if you throw in people who aren't actually undernourished, but who are in danger of being so, that is, who live really on the knife's edge, then you're actually talking about, you know, 10 or 12 million people. The group Bread for the World, Lutheran group, has done a lot of good work on that. But, of course, the big problem is in the global south and the poor world.
Now, going back to Truman's inaugural speech in 1949, I guess, there's been a vast development establishment, World Bank, a whole bunch of regional development banks, a bunch of academics, NGOs that have been set up to address these issues with varying success. Their orthodoxy has changed from Keynesianism to private sector philanthropy, capitalism, NGOism. Are they performing well at this task?
Well, I don't think they are, but the problem is they think they are. I mean, I once wrote in a piece reviewing the Hayekian dissenter, Bill Easterly's last book, that if the development world were a human being, it would be bipolar, or at least a manic depressive, if those two things aren't the same thing, in the sense that development, from the point four in Truman's inaugural speech in 1949 to the present day, the development world goes through this cycle of feeling it's found the answer, and then the answer doesn't work very well, and then they found a new answer, and all the while saying with a perfectly calm and insistent way, this time we've got it, don't tax us with the fact that we've been wrong six or seven times. So yeah, it starts with modernization theory. It goes in the 70s somewhat more promisingly toward a kind of developmentalism that's more concerned with justice. The Reagan-Thatcher revolution kills all that. You get the Washington Consensus, which basically says to poor countries, stop protecting your own markets, make fighting inflation a bigger priority than anything else, stop import substitution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The result, in my view, is disastrous. The result in the world view of the World Bank, even the World Bank today, which claims to be a reformed institution, is that actually it wasn't that unsuccessful, that they didn't mean all the really bad things to happen. They only meant the good things. One of the interesting things about NGOs is development NGOs and emergency relief NGOs, I used to write a lot about that. You know, I would think the overwhelming majority of them think of themselves as on the left. But in my view, you know, the privatization of aid is another emblem of, you know, the privatization of the world. There's only one world system at the moment, and the NGOs, even ones who, like my favorite one, Doctors Without Borders France, the one I'm most sort of intellectually aligned with, I mean, this is all the product of the privatization of the world. And now, you know, the age when rich governments in the global north didn't want to give money to governments in the global south because they said they were all corrupt and would misspend it, but wanted to give it to NGOs, which in turn would have projects in the global south. That looks like the golden age compared to what we've got now, because what we've got now is basically a friendly takeover of the development world in the sense that the development world welcomes it by business. Now business is the point of the spear in the mainstream development world, which I personally think is a disaster. But the view from Davos, if you'll permit me that, is that actually, you know, that this is the new silver bullet is business. It's value chains. It's a combination of technological innovation and sound, socially responsible business that will make value chains in which all boats will rise.
Yeah, instead of seeing business as the center of a capitalist system that generates inequality by its very nature, it's supposed to be, I don't know, in some Hegelian move, the cure for the very thing that it creates.
Well, you know, Francis Fukuyama would have said, and there are certainly people on the left who would agree with him, that he's a kind of Hegelian. And I think the Fukuyama view is now the mainstream view. That is, history's ended. We know what a decent society is. A prosperous society is. It has to be liberal capitalist, sort of America with the bad bits erased, sort of America without Trump and Exxon. that's the view. And so once you take that view in an NGO, in a government, in the media, well, then you think, what's wrong with capitalism? I mean, the human rights movement is absolutely of this type. I used to have debates with Kenneth Roth, the head of Human Rights Watch, who used to say to me, what's wrong with Google? The taxes they pay, for one thing, is a short answer. If corporations paid their fair share of taxes, even what they owe without tax reform, forget about that, if the loopholes were closed. In Africa, people say that you'd have hundreds of billions of dollars more. That alone should tell you why business is not the answer. And the other is that there's a very curious disconnect, because nobody in the mainstream denies that inequality is continuing to rise, even in countries with supposedly better regimes. You know, there's a higher level of income inequality now in South Africa than there was in the apartheid era. And there's a lot of malnutrition and undernutrition in so-called middle-income countries. But somehow we're supposed to believe that hunger and extreme poverty will be abolished. I emphasize the word that the World Bank uses, by 2030 or 2040. But at the same time, inequality just continues to widen. And somehow there's thought to be no contradiction in this.
I'm speaking with David Reif, author of The Reproach of Hunger from Simon & Schuster. Now, a very large figure in all this is a guy who made a fortune out of appropriating other people's intellectual property and then charging monopoly prices for it, Bill Gates. What about him? What kind of work is he doing?
First of all, what's fascinating, again, just to come back to the taxes issue, the Gates Foundation is the richest foundation in the world. The endowment is said to be worth somewhere between $30 and $60 billion, depending on whether you include Warren Buffett's legacy, which he's slowly transferring to the Gates Foundation, of his shares in Berkshire Hathaway, that are supposed to all go, well, with a few minor bequests, to the Gates Foundation at Buffett's death. Again, Microsoft is one of the worst offenders in terms of tax evasion through Ireland, through the Netherlands, Antilles, etc. You know, so if Bill Gates can give his foundation an endowment of $30 billion, it's partly because his shares are worth more than they would be if Microsoft had to pay the taxes it actually owes without the loophole. Look, the philanthropic move is the next move in the business takeover, because, I mean, the Gates Foundation, and this isn't a right-left thing. I mean, I'm sure a lot of your listeners approve of at least some of the things that George Soros has done. And listen, there are things the Gates Foundation does that are fine. They do some very good work in poverty reduction. They also do some things that, in my view, are entirely mistaken. But, you know, what the admirers, a guy called Matthew Bishop, I think he used to write for The Economist, he wrote a book called Philanthrocapitalism. Xerxes didn't have flatterers like that. It's all about how business can do all the things the state can't do. Because the line here is, business can do what the state is sclerotic, inefficient, benighted. Business is cutting edge, efficient, innovative. So the idea is that that's why business has to take the lead in development, socially responsible business, in scare quotes. And the next move were these philanthropies set up by the major plutocrats of our age, Bill Gates being the most important of them. But again, you know, you mentioned intellectual property in the case of Gates. Gates has moved heaven and earth so that, for example, the AIDS program, of which he's played an interesting role, and some of his donations have helped people. There's no doubt about this. You can't diabolize it all. You probably can diabolize what Microsoft did, but that's another conversation. But in doing this good work on it, he's also protected the property regimes, because what he could have done if he wanted to and should have done was to say this is a health crisis and the patent regime should not apply in major epidemics. This is true in the global north in certain cases. In the United States, public health officials have enormous power to do these things if a certain kind of public health emergency is declared. But Gates, you know, is doing the same thing with property rights, with patents, in his philanthropy that he's been doing in his business.
My little book on Hillary Clinton, I compared the efforts of the Clinton Foundation on AIDS in Africa with George W. Bush's, of all people.
Bush was much better.
Yes. I mean, the scale of what the Bush AIDS initiative accomplished in Africa saved many, many, many thousands of lives. You'd need a microscope, really, to measure what the Clinton Foundation does, which, you know, points out the fact that this promotion of philanthropy, which is very much related to the whole, you know, business takeover of the development world, as a substitute for what the state does, it's very inadequate. The state can do a far better job than these private philanthropies can.
You're absolutely right about Bush. Bush, oddly enough, it's the job of every American president to make you nostalgic for his or soon to be, I suppose, her predecessor. Bush was very good about that, and he was actually very good about immigration, much better than Obama has been. I mean, I think the Clinton Foundation is a cesspool. The problem is nobody has the real goods on it. They have sort of the circumstantial evidence, but there are unfortunately no videos of what one imagines takes place when Bill and Hillary Clinton visit, you know, Riyadh, or Riyadh visits them, et cetera, et cetera. The official line is the days of the old capitalists who just wanted to maximize shareholder value and do good for their corporations, but to, you know, to hell with the world, that's over, and the new age of enlightened capitalism, I mean, sort of, we're all Andrew Carnegie's now, is the sort of view that Silicon Valley presents. The state, in my opinion, and I, from your work, I think we agree on this, is the state is not the creature it's portrayed to be. The state was, to some extent, murdered by Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and their heirs and assigns. But I'll give you an example of the effectiveness of a state that goes against all of these notions that you have to have business do all the work, et cetera, et cetera. And that's Brazil. It starts under the neoliberal Cardoso and really gathers pace under Lula, and Dilma has maintained it. Something called Hunger Zero, Fome Zero. And this was done by the state. It did not involve business taking the lead. And what they did was really make huge efforts at a local, regional, and a national level to eliminate child hunger, by which we're talking about, again, malnutrition and undernutrition. It's been a long time since there was a famine in Brazil. But there were huge numbers. And they made amazing progress. And this was a state acting, if you like, a state acting like a state rather than acting like the vassal of Bill Gates and the City of London and lots of other people who call a tune nowadays. And Brazil's not a, you know, Brazil's not Enver Hoxha's Albania. You could do that without turning the system upside down. I mean, Lula and Dilma have not prevented Brazilian billionaires from being even richer. But I think everybody in the political establishment in Brazil, corrupt as it is, understood that this was a matter for the government, for Brazil to do, not for whatever corporation we're talking about in either in Brazil or in the world at large. Mexico's done something of the same thing. So again, in order to have the state work effectively, the heads of the Fortune 500 don't have to commit class suicide.
We've had this transformation in the business ideology where it went from, you know, Carnegie's. You rack up a lot of money doing business, and then, you know, you spend the end of your life plowing it back and doing good. And now we've got this ideology where business itself and its normal operations is doing good and delivering us from ignorance and hunger and poverty.
Yeah, well, I mean, the self-love of business is really, as I say, you know, it would have made the kings of the Persian Empire blush with envy. I think it's extraordinary that, you know, that there's, the line has now been sold. When you say outside the range of a few places in small world of the left that business actually might not have all these good intentions, you're not, it's not that they disagree with you. It's that they think what you're saying is preposterous. It's been so assimilated into the zeitgeist that mainstream media, the academy, never mind, you know, government development agencies like USAID or like DFID in the UK. It's just business is great. Business is the new locus of our collective conscience. Maybe it's just because I'm 63, but I got to tell you, I find this so absurd on its face that it took me years to realize that this was for real, that this wasn't some kind of intentional mystification. To the contrary, it was, I think people, including, I think, Bill and Melinda Gates themselves, truly believe they're not just successful people. They are people doing more good than anyone else.
Well, you have a high degree of confidence coming from this crowd. You know, like even the more sensitive types, like Jeffrey Sachs, pretty funny to think of him now as a more sensitive type.
Oh, but, he's on the far left of this world now, dude.
Yeah, they're talking about making poverty history. Is there any chance of that by their technique and organization?
No, because the idea that you can make poverty history while simultaneously inequality is expanding is absurd on its face, it seems to me, because hunger and poverty are fundamentally problems of justice. They're not problems of production. Even if you think that we need to produce more food, and it's a perfectly respectable view. I mean, since the population is going to go up a lot more, absent some global catastrophe that kills billions, there'll be 10 or 11 billion people on the planet toward the last third of the 21st century. So let's say, for the sake of argument, you don't believe in agroecology, which a lot of critics of the mainstream think can itself solve the problem of producing enough food for a lot more people. But say, for the sake of argument, you think science needs to work on, you know, new seeds and better seeds and more resistant, particularly to climate change. That isn't the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem is Amartya Sen, hardly the second coming of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, has said over and over again, and I think quite well established, is that hunger and poverty are access problems. They're problems of equity. They're not fundamentally problems of supply. And I don't see anything in the current combination of sort of business utopia and scientific and technological utopia that addresses that at all, not least because it can't. How can a world run by people whose whole fortunes are based on or have created this inequality, how can they solve that problem? They, to a very considerable extent, they are the problem.
But they, of course, they always look to technology as the deliverance, because technology will be the instrument that will make everything better without having to take anything away from them.
Well, exactly, and that's the sort of deus ex machina. Gates himself is a very interesting figure. I mean, there's a Rolling Stone interview with him that some years ago that really repays rereading. I mean, he certainly has a view of the world. You can't take that away from him. I don't know if, say, Warren Buffett really does, but Gates sure does. Gates told the following story, that the creator of the American hydrogen bomb, an interesting person to cite, Edward Teller, had said that if he didn't believe in science and that science would continue to improve people's lives, he, Teller, would be a communist. And what Gates said is he didn't believe that the problems of today that remain unsolved, notably climate change, wouldn't be solved by science and the technological applications of science. He, Gates, would be a pessimist. But since he knows that science will continue its triumphal march, there's no reason. He's as the Gates Foundation website calls itself, he's an impatient optimist.
You're a bit of a pessimist yourself, and this book is not one of bringing manifestos towards a transformative change.
No, I mean, that's where, despite my great respect for people like Naomi Klein and the people in the peasant rights movement, right in Bea Campesina, it's a good example, people like Raj Patel and Eric Holt Jimenez, or the rights food people in India, no, I can't share their optimism, and I certainly can't share it over them in short and medium term. Again, right now, capitalism is not just not being transformed, it's everywhere victorious, as near as I can see. Even the few experiments which are, to some extent, want to modify it seem to be collapsing. Venezuela is an obvious example. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that the world that the anti-globalization movement wants to see comes into being in 50 years. That would be very soon, by the way, given where we are now. What do you do in the meantime? I mean, it's true that I'm very pessimistic. I mean, I'm a pessimistic person, and, you know, to some extent, that's probably as much an issue of one's temperament as it is of anything else. But I don't see how, I can see working for that kind of change, but I don't see how that change in the short and medium term is going to help undernourished people. There has to be a better, there has to be an interim solution. And as I said before, I think that interim solution is simply restoring power to the liberal state, forget about any other kind of state, just pushing back against this sort of total domination of the market and of multinationals.
That's David Reif, author of The Reproach of Hunger, Food, Justice, and Money in the 21st Century from Simon & Schuster. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Empire Song by Killing Joke. Musically, it's the early 1980s and Behind the News today. Till next week, bye.